case too, I decided. Thank you, though. Good morning, everybody. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, I'm Judge Tracy Smith, and our Marshal, Paul Baxter, is handling the clock. We are here on case number A19-1638, Hagel versus Safeguard Properties. Can we have counsel for the appellant please identify yourself?
Good morning, Your Honor. Bradley Kirscher on behalf of the appellants, Ronald and Tara Hagel.
Thank you. And for respondent?
Good morning, Your Honor. Sean Redford for Safeguard Properties Management, LLC.
And also good morning, Your Honors. Natalie Walls on behalf of respondents, Keller Williams, Premier Realty, Robert Moreau, and Sean Moreau.
Okay. And as for respondents, do you plan to divide your time?
We do, Your Honor. I'll plan to go first, and we will evenly split it 7.5 minutes each.
Great. Okay, we'll do the clock accordingly, so we'll manage a 7.5 minutes for you. And can everyone hear okay and see?
Yes, Your Honor.
Great. Okay, I would ask if everyone has it, if you're not speaking, if you could just mute your microphone. Does everyone know how to do that?
Yes.
Great, it makes it a little bit better. And then when you, each of you has on each side 15 minutes, counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. So we are ready to go. And when you begin your argument, please just state your name and a party you represent for the record. So we'll all go on mute until we're ready to ask questions then. Thanks.
May it please the court, Bradley Kirscher on behalf of the appellants. The right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate and shall extend to all cases at law without regard to the amount in controversy. That's Article 1, Section 4 of the Minnesota Constitution. And I start with that because in the past few weeks, with civil cases, hearings in civil cases being relegated sort of to the back burner due to the public health crisis that we're in, I think it's important to note that this is a constitutional right that we're dealing with, the right to trial by jury. Now, summary judgment provides a very well-established exception to the constitutional right to a jury trial. But our Supreme Court has labeled it a blunt instrument that is inappropriate when reasonable persons might draw different conclusions from the evidence presented. The Minnesota Supreme Court in 2015, in the case of Rochester City Lines versus Rochester, stated, "We have reiterated on numerous occasions that district courts are not permitted to weigh the evidence in deciding a motion for summary judgment, and that any inferences must be drawn against rather than in favor of the moving party." Now, the most glaring error of the district court in the present case was the finding that, given the relationship between the parties and the nature of the claims being asserted, it is clear that the defendant's interests were represented by Bank of New York Mellon in the prior litigation. Now, the only record evidence of the relationship between the respondents and the Bank of New York Mellon was the contract between respondent Safeguard and Bank of America, which described Safeguard and Bank of America as independent contractors, and specifically states that nothing in the agreement shall create an agency, partnership, employee, or joint venture relationship between them. And that's set forth in Exhibit A of the Meyer Supplemental Affidavit, Section 12.1 of that exhibit. Also the Parker Declaration filed in opposition to summary judgment, Exhibit 18, at that same section 12.1. So the record evidence is a contract between Bank of America and Respondent Safeguard that simply says this does not create an agency relationship. It does not create partnership, joint venture, employee. It keeps them separate. Safeguard was simply an independent contractor of Bank of America. The reason why that,
Mr. Kirscher, let me stop you for a second, please. This is Judge Flory. I just want to make sure that I'm clear on the issues. then, because obviously this was a summary judgment dismissal based on a finding of res judicata. The argument that you just made, or the seemed to apply to the second factor, whether or not Safeguard and Keller Williams were privies to New York Bank of Mellon here. So you may have more argument about that, but I just want to make sure at the district court level, you seem to concede at least two of the four factors for res judicata, that these are the same issues and factual circumstances, and that there was a final judgment on the merits in the previous litigation. So am I correct in that, the record, that you don't challenge those two factors of res judicata here now on appeal?
I have to disagree, Your Honor, specifically because although the appellants at the district court level did concede that there was a final judgment on the merits, they did not concede. In fact, they strongly opposed the idea that it was a final judgment on the merits as it relates to the respondents, the defendants in the district court.
That gets to the second factor, whether they were privies or not, not whether or not they're the same factual circumstances or that there was a final judgment. It seems to me your argument is zeroed in on whether or not the respondents here were privies as opposed to what the issues are.
Well, and in this particular part of my argument, it is focused on that second prong, that privy of a party in the prior litigation. But I think there's and it was meant to be later on in my argument, but I can raise it now because it's raised in my brief, which is the judgment, which was a judgment on the merits as it related to Bank of New York Mellon and MERS, was just that. It had self-limiting language. The judgment specifically said that the Hagel's claims against Bank of New York Mellon and MERS were dismissed with prejudice and judgment be entered thereon. I don't think that for purposes of res judicata, that's sufficient to satisfy that first prong of the four elements to finding res judicata, simply because if the judgment itself is self-limiting, how can it then be used to prevent the Hagels from bringing a claim that was not dismissed by that self-limiting language in the judgment?
Well, I'm looking at the release in the judgment right now, and it seems to be broader than what you've just argued, in that it deals not only with those parties, but also their subsidiaries, affiliates, servicers, agents, attorneys, and other persons or entities similarly connected to Bank of New York Mellon or MERS, and not limited to Bank of America. So it seems much broader than what you've just argued.
Well, so in my analysis in the brief, it looks at it at different levels. The first level being what is the language of the judgment itself? And then it says, alternatively, if you drill down further and you look at the agreement upon which the judgment was entered, because the Minnesota Supreme Court in Henschel v. Smith talks about the importance in construing the effect of a judgment entered upon consent of looking at what the party's intent was. And so in my brief, I look at beyond the language of the judgment itself, the agreement upon which it was based. And that agreement, there was a dispute in what we call the prior litigation. For purposes of this case, frankly, I like to call it the Bank of New York Mellon case, because I think the prior litigation is a little bit of advocacy in language. It makes it seem like the respondents were part of it. It was prior litigation involving the respondents, when in fact it was not. However, if the court looks at the record evidence going to what the settlement agreement upon which it was based, we look at the Hagel's argument that, look, we intended that it only be the named party, Bank of New York Mellon and MERS. However,
why does that matter? Because the parties couldn't agree on the settlement and they litigated that issue, and the judge decided what in fact the agreement was, prepared the order, and dismissed the case on the merits with prejudice. So why would we even look at what the parties thought they were agreeing to. That was resolved when they couldn't agree and the trial court made that determination.
Right. And the trial court determined that the agreement was Bank of New York Mellon, MERS, and their agents, affiliates, servicers, etc. But there was a very specific portion in the record and cited by Mr. Parker, the trial court attorney for the Hagels, in which Judge Dowdle, I believe, the district court judge in the Bank of New York Mellon case, said that the agreement encompasses the agents of Bank of New York Mellon and MERS, which included Bank of America, but did not include and specifically excluded the agents, affiliates, et cetera, of Bank of America. So the court made a determination in the prior litigation, the Bank of New York Mellon case, that Bank of America was specifically included because it was an agent of Bank of New York Mellon, but Bank of America's agents were excluded from that. And that's the specific site. I don't have it in front of me, but it is in Mr. Parker's memorandum of law in opposition to summary judgment. He quotes the language. But again, for purposes of res judicata, there are four factors, and a failure in any one of those four factors prevents res judicata from being a valid basis for summary judgment. And the record evidence as to whether the respondents were privies of Bank of America, because their argument is since we were agents of Bank of America and Bank of America was an agent of Bank of New York Mellon, we are therefore sub-agents of Bank of New York Mellon. And a sub-agent is an agent under the law, and I believe that was disputed. There's law on both sides. But their argument is because we were an agent of Bank of America, we are therefore an agent of Bank of New York Mellon, and therefore we are privies of Bank of New York Mellon and res judicata should apply. But the record evidence, the contract between Respondent Safeguard and Bank of America specifically states this does not create an agency relationship. And so the district court, viewing that evidence as it must in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, the Hagels, had to look at that and must have ignored it, because I think that is the best evidence of what in fact is the relationship between the respondents and Bank of America, and it specifically is not an agency relationship. It's simply a relationship of an independent contractor. Therefore, without privity, res judicata does not apply. And I think that's the easiest basis on which to reverse the grant of summary judgment. Just simply the fact that there is record evidence that creates a genuine issue of material fact as to that privity prong. But I think that there are also very important.
This is Judge Riley. I have a question. I just want to understand the litigation involving Bank of New York. The claim there, the injury was that they weren't allowed to collect their personal property. Property wasn't properly secured, and it resulted in loss, damage. And that was a claim, right?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And is that the same claim that you're currently making?
Yes, Your Honor, the damages are the same. The one thing that I was unable to reconcile myself is that the Hagels claim, and they presented at the district court level, that they didn't know about Bank of America's involvement until very far into the case. And so I believe that there was a concession by Mr. Parker that the facts and circumstances were the same. But to say the facts and circumstances that we litigated in the Bank of New York Mellon case were the same as the facts and circumstances in this case, when we didn't even know that these entities were involved at that time, I just have trouble reconciling it. But I do have to concede that I believe it was agreed to or conceded at the district court level.
Thank you.
Well, is there evidence in the record, though, Mr. Kircher, that as far back as 2012, the counsel for the Hagels had written a letter to the Bank of New York Mellon regarding this matter, or Bank of America? It seems like there was contact long ago between the parties regarding the preservation of the personal property and the ability to get it.
I believe, Your Honor, that the communication between the Hagels' attorney back during, while all this was happening, was mainly with Orrin Kipp, the attorney for Bank of New York Mellon, for purposes of the foreclosure and eviction action. There was, of course, in the record, communication with the real estate agent, with Keller Williams as well, because the record evidence shows that the attorney was somewhat delegating or at least advising the real estate agent on what needed to be done. Now, the district court did find that there was evidence that the Hagels should have known of Safeguard and Keller Williams' role going back there, because there were, I guess, notices posted at the property. And therefore, the Hagels must have been aware, because they must have seen those notices with the name Safeguard on them. And again, I think that violates the rules that govern summary judgment, which is that inferences cannot be made in favor of the moving party. They can only be made in favor of the non-moving party. And I think that requires a logical inference to go from the evidence that there were postings with the name Safeguard on them to the Hagels having actual knowledge of Safeguard's role in what was happening back in 2012, back during that time. Because of that inference being made incorrectly, I believe that's another error that would require reversal of summary judgment.
Counsel, I think we're out of time for your primary argument. My colleagues, do you have any other questions at this time?
None here.
Great. Otherwise, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And now we're going to set up 7.5 minutes for each of the respondents. And Mr. Redford, you're going first. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
And okay. State your name and your party represent again, if you would.
Yes, Your Honor. Sean Redford for respondent Safeguard Properties Management, LLC. And may it please the court, I'm happy to be here this morning, Your Honor, and respond to these arguments here today. I think I just heard appellant concede as to element one of res judicata, which was conceded already at summary judgment, but seemed to be re-argued on appeal. So I'm going to go ahead and skip over that unless there's additional questions for me on this on the first element, which was same set of factual circumstances. Instead, I'd like to focus on the privity issue, as well as the full and fair opportunity to litigate, which Mr. Kircher has indicated he believes that there was an improper weighing of evidence by the district court. Your Honor, that's not what happened here. First of all, as to the question of privity and agency.
Let me just, as you begin the argument, I'd ask that you, in that argument, address Mr. Redford, the argument made by appellant that the contract between Safeguard and Bank of America was an independent contractor agreement, not and excluded any agency relationship, so as to not fall within the release from the prior litigation.
Right. Yeah, Your Honor, I definitely will address that. In fact, I'll go ahead and do so now. And there's really two contexts in which that apply. Is number one in the analysis of res judicata, and then the separate argument, which is another basis on which to affirm summary judgment on behalf of Safeguard, which is that Safeguard was released as part of that contractual release. And we need to go back to the beginning of this case. And if you look at the appellant's complaint and all of the arguments that they made at summary judgment, it was their position, and in fact, their entire case is predicated upon Safeguard being an agent of BNY Mellon. If we're not an agent, there is no liability under the statute. And so for purposes of summary judgment, ironically enough, we conceded that we were an agent, that Safeguard was an agent of Bank of New York Mellon and of Bank of America, because that was the argument that appellants were making at summary judgment. And so the irony here is that we were the ones attempting to avoid having there be a fact dispute on that point. And now it's somehow trying to be used against us. So for purposes of summary judgment, we had conceded that we are an agent of Bank of America and of Bank of New York Mellon. Now, what's interesting is in their summary judgment argument below, they actually expressly acknowledge that Bank of America was an agent of BNY Mellon and that Safeguard was an agent of Bank of America. They make those express arguments. However, they say that somehow it doesn't equate to Safeguard being an agent of BNY Mellon. I haven't seen any legal authority for that position. In fact, all the case law establishes that if a subagent is an agent under Minnesota law, and that's really not in any genuine dispute here. And so that applies both, again, as I said, to the release argument and unto the analysis of privity under res judicata. However, our privity argument is not reliant solely on agency. Even if it was determined by this court that there was some question as to agency, there are still other bases on which Safeguard is in privity with BNY Mellon here. When you look at the two cases, the prior litigation in this case, and the fact that they involve the same set of factual circumstances, the interests of Safeguard and BNY Mellon here are identical. And the case law says that privity is established when the parties are so identified in interest as to essentially represent the same legal right. And that's exactly what happened here. You had the prior litigation, and it was regarding the eviction of the of appellants, and then the preservation of their personal property, and then the access to that property, and then the handling of that property, and whether that was negligent. Those are the exact same claims being made here against Safeguard. So these in this case, these two parties who are connected at minimum by a contract, but also by agency, as we argue, they are just so intertwined that they cannot be separated for purposes of res judicata here. And so I hope that answers your question, Your Honor. And then moving on to, I'll address briefly the final judgment on the merits. Appellants have argued now here that the settlement agreement that resulted in a judgment dismissing the case was a consent judgment. And I certainly follow that argument. However, the case law that they cite, there's some ways that it is distinguished from this present case. In the Henschel case that they cite, a big factor in that case was that the parties to the settlement agreement had agreed to a specific carve-out where the plaintiff could go ahead and pursue claims against another third party. That's not what happened here. There is no carve-out that says that appellants were agreeing with BNY Mellon that they could go ahead and pursue Safeguard. They certainly could have included that language in the settlement agreement. As I understand it in the record, appellants at minimum have acknowledged that they are aware of Safeguard's involvement before they entered into the settlement agreement, even if they are disputing that they knew of Safeguard's involvement back in 2012 when the lawsuit, the prior litigation, commenced. And Your Honor, there's case law that says, the Goldberger case, for example, that a settlement agreement that results in a final judgment of dismissal is a final judgment on the merits. And I've not seen any case law that says that rule of law does not apply in the res judicata context. And then the final element, the full and fair opportunity to litigate. Your Honors, the prior litigation went on for 6 years. Appellants were represented by counsel the entire time. And at summary judgment, the district court did not weigh the evidence here when looking at what it was that appellants knew about Safeguard involvement. What they were looking at was whether appellants had raised sufficient actual disputed facts to prevent the summary judgment ruling. And in this case, there is no actual facts that cut against what we've argued here. And the district court didn't make a factual determination. What it made was an observation that the legal argument made by appellants at summary judgment was unpersuasive. And
counsel, your time is up.
Thank you.
Ms. Walls, if you could state your name and the party.
Yes, Your Honor. Natalie Walls on behalf of respondents Keller Williams Premier Realty, Robert Moreau, and Sean Moreau. May it please the court, like Safeguard, Keller Williams was granted summary judgment on the basis of res judicata. So I'm going to do my best to not cover the same ground here as Mr. Redford did, but I want to touch on the differences that apply to Keller Williams as opposed to Safeguard, which necessarily results in dismissal of the appellant's claims against Keller Williams. I want to address the second element first, which is privity. There's no set test which determines privity, and privity is broader than the concept of a contract or agency. Privity exists where a party would have no reason to take the challenged action if not acting for another, or where their party's interests are represented by the party to the action. Here, Keller Williams had no reason to take any action with respect to appellant's personal property if not acting for Bank of New York Mellon. Keller Williams was the real estate agent for the property. Bank of New York Mellon was the owner. Real estate agents don't take any action with respect to property unless they're directed to do so by the owner. And in fact, there's evidence in the record that Bank of New York Mellon was communicating with Keller Williams and was directing Keller Williams with respect to appellant's personal property. Therefore, Bank of New York Mellon represented Keller Williams' interest in the prior litigation that had to deal with the improper handling of appellant's personal property. Appellants like to characterize Bank of New York Mellon and Keller Williams as joint tortfeasors. But even if that's the proper characterization of the two parties, they haven't presented any evidence to negate the existence of the privity. And where privity exists between two joint tortfeasors, all those tortfeasors need to be sued in one action. Therefore, the district court correctly found that privity existed between Keller Williams and Bank of New York Mellon. Going to the fourth element of res judicata, full and fair opportunity to litigate, appellants commenced the lawsuit against Bank of New York Mellon and MERS in December 2012. Appellants claim in an affidavit that in August 2012, Keller Williams denied them access to the property to retrieve their personal property. Appellants' lawsuit, as Mr. Redford mentioned, with Bank of New York Mellon lasted for 6 years, including an appeal to this court and a remand. And that lawsuit involved claims regarding the removal and storage of their personal property. Therefore, not only did appellants have a full and fair opportunity to litigate those claims, they did so with full knowledge of Keller Williams' involvement in the removal and storage of their personal property. The district court therefore correctly found that appellants had a full and fair opportunity to litigate their claims in the prior litigation. With respect to the first and, you know, third elements of res judicata, whether the cases involve the same set of factual circumstances, and whether there was a final judgment on the merits. As has been pointed out, the appellants did not dispute these issues in district court, and therefore it's our position that they have waived the right to dispute those now on appeal. But even if we want to consider those elements are satisfied. It can't reasonably be disputed that the prior litigation and this action involved the same set of factual circumstances. Appellants like to contend that different facts are required in order to establish their claims against the different parties. But even if we want to assume that that's true, all those operative facts arise from the same set of factual circumstances. So the first element is satisfied. There also is no dispute that the prior litigation resulted in a dismissal with prejudice against Bank of New York Mellon and MERS. The settlement agreement upon which that dismissal was based demonstrates that it resolved and dismissed appellant's claims for breach of Minnesota statute section 504B.365, 504B.271, as well as the negligence of Bank of New York Mellon and MERS, because that was litigated in the prior litigation. Therefore, all the elements of res judicata have been satisfied, and the district court properly granted summary judgment in favor of Keller Williams, and that judgment should be affirmed. In addition to granting summary judgment on the basis of res judicata, Keller Williams set forth in its brief the alternative grounds by which summary judgment could be affirmed in favor of Keller Williams, and I'll just briefly touch on those. Appellant's claim for a breach of Minnesota statute 504B.365 and 504B.271 require Keller Williams to be acting as an agent of Bank of New York Mellon, who was the landlord in the eviction action. Keller Williams can't be an agent of Bank of New York Mellon for purposes of their statutory claims, but not be an agent of Bank of New York Mellon for purposes of the settlement agreement. So either Keller Williams was Bank of New York Mellon's agent and appellants have released those claims against Keller Williams, or Keller Williams was not Bank of New York Mellon's agent, and therefore they can't assert these statutory claims against Keller Williams. With respect to appellant's negligence claim, the record is, there's no evidence in the record that any action by Keller Williams was the proximate cause of any of the plaintiff or appellant's damages. They've presented no evidence that any action by Keller Williams, including not preparing an inventory of their personal property, resulted in any of their personal property being stolen or destroyed. The record shows that none of appellant's personal property was destroyed or stolen while Keller Williams was the real estate agent for the property. And the record further shows that multiple real estate agents became the real estate agent after Keller Williams was no longer affiliated with the property. And that's when their personal property was stolen or destroyed. We therefore ask that the district court's decision granting summary judgment in favor of Keller Williams be affirmed. Unless there's any other questions for me, that is all I have, Your Honors.
Great. Thank you very much, counsel. And counsel for appellant, Mr. Kircher, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Bradley Kircher for the appellants. I'd like to start by pointing out that agency is not required for these statutory claims. Minnesota Statute 504B.271 sub 2 states, if a landlord, an agent, or other person acting under the landlord's direction or control in possession of tenant's personal property fails to allow the tenant to retake possession. So it's broader than the landlord. It's broader than an agent of the landlord. And in fact, there's also, it states that it's not only a landlord, but it applies in the case of a foreclosure. So the Bank of New York Mellon, but anyone who is acting on behalf or in control of Bank of New York Mellon is subject to the requirement of the statute. There's another section, and I think it was a footnote in my reply brief, 504B3.365 subdivision 5. Talks about a plaintiff, an agent, or other person acting under plaintiff's direction or control who enters the premises and removes property. So the statute isn't limited to an agent. That being said, agency isn't necessarily enough to create and to make the respondents a privy for purposes of res judicata. I heard an argument that privity is broader than agency, and I'd say that the case law wholeheartedly disagrees with that. Rucker v. Schmidt, 768 Northwest 2nd 408 at page 415, Minnesota Court of Appeals 209. Court of Appeals said, Minnesota has not expressed a relaxed privity concept. Further on at page 417 of the same case, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has not announced a relaxed application of privity in every principal agent relationship. Again, at 417 of the same case, we have stated that to bind a non-party to the results of a prior suit, the non-party must have, in quotes, so controlled an action in advancing her own interest that the non-party has had her day in court. So looking at the case law for res judicata, the standard is not whether or not you are an agent or a sub-agent of the party in the prior litigation. It goes beyond that. They talk about, although not being named, being in control of the litigation. It talks about simply being on the same side in litigation not being sufficient. It has to be a relationship in existence at the time of the actions in dispute. Privity is narrow, and they're trying to expand it. And the problem with the expansion of res judicata is that by expanding it the way that the respondents want, it conflicts with a well-settled legal principle. That the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that in cases of tort and similar statutory cases, that a plaintiff can bring a claim against joint tortfeasors either in a single action or in separate actions. And that is, I'll state that a plaintiff is not required to join all tortfeasors in a single suit. That's really the Money Mutual 2015 Minnesota Court of Appeals case 863 Northwest 2nd 789 at page 796. That was then appealed to the Supreme Court and approved and remanded. But that case cites a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2007, Harrison X. Rel. Harrison 733 Northwest 2nd 451 at page 456, which in turn is based on an older case, Kish v. Scow. And Kish v. Scow was a case where the plaintiff brought a claim against the driver for a motor vehicle accident and then subsequently brought a claim against the owner of the vehicle for under the claim of vicarious liability as an owner of a motor vehicle. And I think that's very similar to a situation where you talk about an independent contractor and a principal relationship, is that they're being sued for the same action. So in Kish v. Scow, the plaintiff sued for the exact same cause of action, and the Minnesota Supreme Court said, that's fine. That prior action does not prevent the subsequent action simply because the plaintiff chose to sue the joint tortfeasors in separate actions. It's a well-established principle of law announced by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and to apply res judicata in this case would work an injustice on the Hagels, because it would be dismissal by surprise. If they bring a subsequent action based on a well-established principle announced by the Minnesota Supreme Court and it's dismissed because they chose to follow what the Supreme Court said they could do, that works an injustice. And that is the most important thing that a court needs to look at when applying res judicata, right?
Counsel, your time is up. Thank you very much. Do my colleagues have any questions? No? Okay, great. I think everything went very smoothly. Mr. Redford, Ms. Walz, we could definitely hear, see you great. Mr. Kircher, you just had occasional hiccups. We heard everything, but occasional freezing of your face just for a few seconds. I think that happened on some of us too. That's usually just a Wi-Fi issue on that person's part. So FYI, if you're participating in future hearings, just so that you know that maybe there's a way to improve the Wi-Fi a little tiny bit. But I didn't miss a thing you said, and there were only occasional moments. So thank you all very much for participating, and the case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.